K-Mud Podcast presents.
And now it is time for Heart of the Earth.
Does not sell the earth, the people walk upon. We are the land. How do we sell our mother? How do we sell the stars? How do we sell the air? Crazy horse, we hear what you say. Too many people standing their ground, standing the wrong ground. Predator's face, be possessed a race, possession, a war that doesn't end. Children of God, feed on children of earth. Days people don't care for people, these days are the hardest. Material fields, material harvest, decoration on chain that binds. Mirrors gold. The people lose their minds. Crazy horse. We hear what you say. One earth, one mother. One does not sell the earth. The people walk upon it.
Return.
Genetic light from the other side. A song from the heart. Our hearts to give. The wild days. The glory days. Live. Crazy horse. We hear what you say. One earth. One mother. One does not sell the earth. The people walk. We are the land. How do we sell our mother? How do we sell the stars? How do we sell the air? Crazy horse, we hear what you say. Crazy horse, we hear what you say. We are the seventh generation. We are the seventh generation.
Good morning, and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes, and I'll be with you until 10 a.m. And support for KMUD comes from Soham Health's Garberville Optometry, now serving Southern Humboldt with its mobile optometry unit, offering eye exams, screenings, and treatment for eye-related conditions. Glass fittings and contact lenses are also available, and they're open Tuesday through Thursday behind Garberville Pharmacy. And there's more information at sohumhealth.org/optometry or 707-923-3921. And support for KMUD also comes from the Driving Clean Assistance Program and Central California Asthma Collaborative, co-hosting the North Coast Ride and Drive event, and that's on Saturday, October 4th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Redwood Acres Fields in Eureka. Attendees can test drive electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles, meet local experts, and learn about clean air programs. Resource fair featuring locals like the RCEA, Adventures Edge, and Green Wired. More info at Driving Clean. DrivingCleanCA.org. And I opened with John Trudell, Crazy Horse. It was a live version recorded July 12th of 2002 in Paris, France. And I thought I'd open with that because I want to talk a little bit about Wounded Knee. But before I do, I do want to mention that yesterday was Orange Shirt Day. And it represents all the children who were forced into boarding schools. It started in Canada with the orange shirt because there was a young girl when she was maybe, 5 or 6 years old, and she was being taken to boarding school, and her grandmother knew that she was going to be going to school, and she wanted to make sure that, she was dressed real nice. And so she made her this orange blouse, a really nice orange shirt, brand new. And of course, as soon as she got off the bus and into the school, they ripped it off of her and she never saw it again. And so September 30th has become Orange Shirt Day. And all over the country, all over Canada, the United States, there was Orange Shirt Days and there were gatherings. And it's just such an intense experience in reading some of the stories. And I thought, gosh, I'll just mention in passing about yesterday. And yes, I did. Even though I was working away yesterday, I wore my orange shirt all day yesterday and to honor the boarding school victims. And it's really hard for me because I remember 35 years ago, I would talk about boarding schools and people would say, well, I never heard about that, Agnes. You're just making this up. And I would try to tell people, no, it's a real thing. They forced, Native children into schools. And of course, not until they found the unmarked graves in British Columbia about 5 years, it's even less than that, I think maybe 4 years ago, have word come out. And because of Deb Haaland, who was Secretary of the Interior, she had hearings all across this country and had people tell their stories. And it was just atrocious the way children were treated. But that's just the way the world is right now, then and now. Well, I started with Crazy Horse because I think of Wounded Knee, Crazy Horse, and Sitting Bull. And their victory at Little Bighorn. Yep, when Custer ate it. But the retaliation was the massacre at Wounded Knee. And it was just horrible what happened there. But I'm going to share with you even worse. because the Wounded Knee Memorial is a memorial site of the Wounded Knee Massacre on the Pine Ridge Reservation, where more than 250 Lakota people, mainly women and children, were killed on December 29th of 1890. 20 soldiers were awarded the Medal of Honor for their participation in what the U.S. calls the Battle of Wounded Knee. Efforts to rescind the medals given to soldiers from the 1890 Wounded Knee Massacre were halted when Defense Secretary last week, Peter Hegseth, announced that they would keep them. The Wounded Knee Massacre is arguably one of the most brutal and traumatic acts of violence documented against American Indian people, where more than 250 Lakota, yes, the majority of them women and children, were gunned down and killed after rumors a shot was fired from a Lakota person after they volunteered to surrender their weapons on December 30th of 1890. Quote, stolen valor, that's what awarding medals for slaughtering unarmed women, children, and non-combatants is, said Chase Iron Eyes, executive director of Lakota People's Law Project, in a statement. Quote, we are at war with liars, racist, spineless rats, unfit for righteous leadership, unfit to decide when our beloved soldiers should live or die. We, the American people, are rebuilding our honor one day, one working family at a time, and we are defending our country from corporate shills and fascists. More medals of honor were given to soldiers involved in the Wounded Knee Massacre than the total amount of South Dakotians who participated in World War II for 4 years. There have been several efforts to rescind the medals given to soldiers at Wounded Knee, including resolutions passed by the South Dakota Senate and congressional efforts, but Congress does not have the authority to award medals of honor. Only the president does. Quote, under my direction, we're making it clear without hesitation that the soldiers who fought in the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890 will keep their medals, and we're making it clear that they deserve those medals, said Secretary Hegseth on X last Thursday evening. After the killings at Wounded Knee, the U.S. military and its acting agents all gathered their bodies and buried them in a mass grave at the site of the incident. Today, the 40-acre site is owned by the Oglala Sioux Tribe and the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and South Dakota's lone Congressman Dusty Johnson, who's campaigning to be South Dakota's next governor, introduced a bill, Wounded Knee Massacre Memorial and Sacred Site Act, to add additional protections to the site. If passed, the land would be placed in restricted fee status, meaning it cannot be sold, taxed, gifted, or leased without approval by Congress and both tribes. And I have to interject here, you know, I have been there numerous times, and it's up on a hill. But when you're standing on the hill and you look down, and you look down at the creek, you know the history there. If you know the history, you know what happened. And it's just, it really moves you in a way that you wonder now, today, you know, how they're trying to erase so much of this history. But to continue, South Dakota's Searchlight reported that South Dakota Senator Mike Rounds plans to reintroduce his own version in the U.S. Senate. Johnson's last attempt passed the House in 2023, but was blocked by North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis in an effort to get other senators to support his bill advocating for Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina's federal recognition. Quote, their place in our national history is no longer up for debate, Hegseth concluded. Quote, Secretary Hegseth's refusal is despicable, untruthful, and insulting to the great Sioux Nation, said Oglala Sioux Tribal President Frank Starr, comes out in a statement on Friday. Quote, more than 300 unarmed Lakota men, women, and children were massacred at Wounded Knee. It was not a battle. It was revenge for America's only loss on what they considered their own soil, the Battle of Little Bighorn on June 25th of 1876. It was the 7th Cavalry, led by Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer, who was defeated by the Great Sioux Nation. We were never defeated militarily. The United States government comes to us and negotiated treaties of peace. Yet to this day, we must continue to fight to see them honored. And this came from Darren Thompson, who was the managing editor of Last Real Indians. also from the Lakota law offices. And, you know, Segwith, you know, he's taken aim at diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at the Pentagon since he took office. The Pentagon has ended commemorations of Identity Month celebrations like Native American History Month, Black History Month, and the Pentagon drew a fire earlier this year for briefly erasing online references to the Navajo code talkers who developed an unbreakable code that helped Allied forces win World War II. And yes, he had all the generals from all over the world come to Washington yesterday, and him and Trump got up and talked, and I guess they were expecting all this standing ovation, and there was dead silence when they spoke from the generals. But yeah, wounded knee. Not going to rescind those medals. Was Walela, Wounded Knee. I'm going to share this with you. And again, this is our fun drive. And come by the station, send us some checker money order. And just in a short while, we'll have phone answers when you call 707-923-3911. Heart of the Earth has been on KMUD since the first day we ever went on air. I've been here this whole time. And I will be here until I take my last breath, because the truth must always be told. The truth. This is from Native News Online. The Trail of Tears National Historic Trail spans 9 states and traces thousands of miles across both land and water routes. In 1838 and 1839, more than 16,000 Cherokee men, women, and children were forcibly removed from their ancestral homeland in the southern Appalachian Mountains. They were first confined in stockades and internment camps, then compelled to walk hundreds of miles to Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma. The forced migration, marked by extreme hardship, led to widespread illness, desertion, and the deaths of thousands of Native people. The history isn't pretty, but it's factual. It is not simply Native American history. It is American history. The Trail of Tears National Historic Trail was established to preserve this tragic chapter in American history, honoring the routes taken and protecting the sites that commemorate the Cherokees' forced migration. Some of the markings that tell the story of the Trail of Tears may be at risk because of Executive Order 14253, signed by President Donald Trump on March 27th of 2025. The executive order, titled, quote, "Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History," is a sweeping policy aimed at removing what the administration calls, quote, disparaging or quite divisive signs, plaques, and markers on federal lands, including national parks and public monuments. And I have to interject here. And my husband and I were at what they call Devil's Tower, or Bear's Lodge, in Wyoming. And when we came around, and there was supposed to be this information booth, but it was this kiosk, but nobody was there. They had some papers there, but taped to the boards there. If you find anything that's disparaging, please contact, there was putting signs up telling people, if you don't like this, let us know and we'll take it down. Seriously. To continue. Couched in language about, quote, highlighting the beauty of the American landscape, it's part of the administration's broad political attempt to sanitize U.S. history for a new generation. For Cherokee Nation Principal Chuck Hoskin Jr., this executive order is not about truth. Hoskin explained that if federal officials follow the executive order's requirements to identify sites that portray the United States negatively, the Trail of Tears would qualify, given that it involves the government rounding up people into stockades and forcing them on a deadly march across the country. Quote, if you take their dictate to its logical conclusion, then we can't talk about the Trail of Tears, and that's just wrong, Chief Hoskin said. Hoskin called the potential impact a, quote, disservice, and believes tribal leaders need to engage directly with the Trump administration. He thinks federal officials would listen, if tribes explained how the directive could result in one of the darkest chapters of American history getting pushed aside or whitewashed. And believe me, that was the whole purpose of his executive order. To continue, I think they'll say, you know what? We didn't intend for that to happen. We have to speak out when we can. When Chief Hoskin is referring to its tribal consultation, I hope there will be tribal consultation on this issue so that tribes can have their say about the federal government whitewashing history. Many of the stories told on signs, markers, and plaques across this country are already incomplete. Most parks barely scratch the surface when it comes to telling the full story of Native presence on this land. Where our stories do appear are interpretive panels at massacre sites in exhibits recounting broken treaties or on plaques explaining the displacement of our ancestors. They are the result of long, hard fights by tribal nations, historians, and allies demanding a sliver of justice through public memory. Now even those hard-won stories are under threat. This executive order is a political act. It claims to promote unity, but it does so by denying hard truths. It promotes patriotism, but by silencing voices that challenge the mythology of American exceptionalism. It says it wants to, quote, restore history, but what it really aims to do is rewrite again in the image of the colonizer. We've seen this tactic before in the boarding schools that tried to, quote, kill the Indian and save the man. in the textbooks that described Native peoples as vanished, in the maps that renamed our rivers, our hills, our homelands. This is not new, but it is dangerous. When you remove the sign that tells the story of the Trail of Tears from a national park, what are you doing? You are not promoting unity. You are covering up a forced death march. When you edit a plaque or downplay a massacre at Sand Creek or Wounded Knee, you are not healing. You are erasing. You are telling future generations that Native pain does not matter, that Native survival is an inconvenient footnote, and that Native memory can be negotiated. As a tribal citizen and a journalist, this is from Levi Rickick, I've walked the lands where signs now stand, faint attempts to acknowledge the blood spilled, the lives lost, the cultures shattered. These markers are not perfect, but they are needed. They say, we were here. They say, this happened. They say, remember. Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum, under orders from the White House, has already begun reviewing park signage deemed too, quote, negative. Rangers have been told to report anything that paints, quote, Americans past or present in a bad light. But who decides what is negative? And more importantly, whose America are we talking about? For Native peoples, America has always been a paradox, a land we love, and a government that has tried to erase us from it. We are Americans, yes, but we are also sovereign peoples, and our history, our true history, cannot be edited away for the comfort of tourists or politicians. Hoskin is correct. Tribal consultation is required before any sign should be taken down. America deserves the truth.
Those ghosts that pass on the plains, why do they limp? Why are they maimed? It's the Trail of Tears. It's the Trail of Tears. They called it the Cherokee Removal, but the contractors didn't care. Well, they rode in wagons, and they walked barefoot, and they walked in the winter air. Who are those ghosts that pass on the plains? Why do they limp? Why are they maimed? It's the Trail of Tears. It's the Trail of Tears. They moved an entire Indian nation from Tennessee and the South, taking them west to a new reservation. And the Oklahoma drought. Who are those ghosts pass on the plains? And why do they limp? And why are they maimed? It's the Trail of Tears. It's the Trail of Tears. The contractors didn't care how they moved them, so they herded them like cattle, mile by mile. The women and children died, and instead of drums, death rattles. Who are those ghosts that pass on the plains? Why do they limp? Why are they maimed? It's a trail of tears. It's a trail of tears. They died by tens and hundreds and thousands. Still the march went on. The contractors are gonna make a buck, and so they forged on. And they got him to Oklahoma, and they settled him down. And when they got them settled down on Oklahoma's arid soil, there were only a few that had begun. And then that few struck oil. Tell me, who are those ghosts we see on the plains? Why do they stagger? Why are they maimed? Why do they wander? Why are they lost? How much America has this betrayal cost?
And that was Peter LaFarge. The Trail of Tears from his As Long as the Grass Shall Grow. He passed away sometime in the 60s. This was recorded in the 60s, I believe. 1964, he recorded that. I'm going to share this with you. It's from Julie Francella. Her writings are just incredible. And she wrote this one a couple of weeks ago, maybe or the 22nd, I think I have it. But I just thought it was just so important to share. And it's entitled, What If Hate Isn't What You Think It Is? On Extremism, Empathy, and the Long Road Home. Let me start here. I've sat with people in the darkest corners of their lives, men, women, and teens, tangled in systems of abuse and cycles of violence, addiction, grief, and shame. I've seen what happens when people stop being seen as people and become nothing more than their ideologies, flattened, feared, and written off. It's not just the systems that erase their humanity. It's the collective refusal to imagine there's anything more to them. I've sat across from people who told me, straight-faced, that they hated Native people. Not metaphorically, but directly. They spoke of us as burdens, as less than, as lazy, as drunk, as undeserving. Some blamed us for the ills of the country. Others laughed at the idea that we had survived anything worth grieving. I've had to sit, breathe, and not flinch when someone in my care mocked our ceremonies or called Indigenous women breeders or questioned whether residential schools were really, quote, that bad. People who said hospital resources were being wasted on brown Native babies and that we should all be sterilized or worse, killed. I wish I were exaggerating. I'm not. These weren't just offhand comments on the internet, though I've received plenty of those too. These were real people in real rooms under my care, often handed to me by systems and people that gave up on them or labeled them as far too gone. And yet they came, sometimes by court order, sometimes by a threat of willingness. Sometimes they didn't know that they were about to be in a conversation with someone they had been taught to hate. They looked at me in the face and said the most vile things about people like me, like my mother and my community. It's not easy to sit in those rooms. I don't pretend otherwise. There were days I left shaking or cried the whole drive home. Days I felt like I was betraying myself just by showing up again the next morning. I've seen online commenters threaten genocide, joke about, quote, finishing the job Andrew Jackson started, or dismiss our grief when yet another young Native person dies by suicide. But here's what I've learned. Hate doesn't make someone irredeemable. It makes them disconnected from others, from themselves and their own humanity. The truth is, if I begin to see them as less than human, I risk losing my own humanity in return. I've also seen the moment when something shifts, when they are when they are met not with more hate or punishment, but with the radical and disarming power of being understood. Not agree with or excluded, but understood. And at this moment, when extremism is rising again in the U.S., when hate speech and dehumanization are once more policy adjacent, I find myself coming back to this truth. Fighting hate with hate doesn't work. It never has. And just a little while ago, I was talking to someone about, you know, trying to relate to your audience, because I've done a lot of public speaking. And one time, it was in the later 80s, and I was a guest speaker at the University of Colorado. In fact, I had replaced Bill Wapapa, who had passed on. And when I arrived, they said, oh, we heard he died, so we cut out that part of the program. It was all about rainforest, and I was the only Native person there. But since I was there, they said, okay, well, they'll give me 5 minutes. And I took 20 and got a standing ovation. But when I was standing there and I looked out in the audience, I noticed some cowboy hats, you know, some young cowboys out there. And when I was talking about all the things that had happened to the Native people, I looked at them and I said, you know, the new Indian of today is the family farmer, because that was what was going on right at that time. I said, the family farmers losing their land to major corporations, and those people have worked that land. They know the weather. They know. I said, and now they're losing that to the greed, to the corporations. And when I was through, I actually had a young cowboy come up and shake my hand and said, I don't even know if I'll be able to finish in school. I feel like I need to go back and help my family because we're losing our land. And he thanked me. I could have looked at those cowboys and said a lot of horrible things about, you know, what happened. But I related to them at that moment. And they acknowledged that. To continue, we cannot scream each other out of hate. We cannot legislate humanity into someone's heart. What we can do, what we must do, is meet each other with curiosity, with boundaries, and with a relentless insistence on one another's humanity. We live in a culture addicted to righteousness. Online and off, we're taught to win. We're told that to understand the other side is to betray our own values. But that's a false binary. Empathizing with someone does not mean you agree with them. It means you recognize that they, like you, are a human being shaped by pain, context, fear, and story. And it's through that human door, not through hate or cancellation, that real change begins. We know this because we've seen it. Years ago, I worked with people affiliated with gangs who had committed serious acts of violence. I wasn't there to excuse what they did. I was there to help them on their healing journey. And as long as someone is still breathing, there's the possibility of change. I don't say that from some romanticized lens. As I've said, I've seen how brutal people can be, but I've also seen what happens when someone finally feels seen, not for the worst thing they've done, but for the parts of them that existed before they were taught to hate. Angela King once wore swastikas and preached hate. She was deep in a violent white supremacist network in Florida. She was arrested in 1998 after robbing a Jewish-owned store and was sent to prison. While incarcerated, something cracked open. It wasn't a TED talk or an argument on Twitter. It was a friendship with a Jamaican woman who treated her with unexpected kindness. That connection dismantled the lie she had been built her life around. Today, Angela is co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit helping people leave extremist groups. They offer counseling, community, and support from people who've been there. Because sometimes to walk someone out of darkness, you need to know the terrain. Christian Piccolini became a neo-Nazi skinhead at just 14. For 8 years, he led violent hate groups and helped recruit others into the same darkness he was raised in. His way out wasn't clean or linear. It was messy, slow, and often painful. What ultimately made it possible was relationship. People met him where he was. He found new friends, a new sense of identity, and spaces that were willing to hold the broken parts of him without excusing the harm he had caused. That's what began to unravel the hate. He went on to start the Free Radicals Project, guiding others out of hate groups using tools of empathy and understanding. What the research shows again and again is this: people don't join hate movements just because they're ideologically convinced. They join because they're looking for meaning, for identity, for a place to belong, and extremist groups know how to offer that fast and loud. And I want to interject here because, you know, during the 60s and 70s and 80s, before it was all the internet stuff, you know, when the FBI wanted to stop what they call radical groups, the left side or whatever, you know, they have infiltrators come in and then they would spy and then they would let them go back. You know, I've lived through it. But then once the internet happened, they didn't have to do that because they could just interject, you know, on the sites. You know, and I, to this day, I really feel that's what happened when that kid that shot Trump, you know, they got into, you know, he started getting messages, you know, on his internet. Same with the one who just shot that Kirk guy. You know, he was on Discord and these other things. They find that and they interject things because they know how to turn the minds of these young people and get them to do what they need to do. Just a warning. A 2021 study called Walking Out on Hate found that former extremists often began leaving only after forging relationships with people outside the movement, people who offered belonging without requiring violence. When we write people off as irredeemable, we shut the door to that possibility. Let's be honest, people don't change their minds when they're screamed at. They change when someone asks them, "What happened to you?" They change when they feel safe enough to question their old stories. They change when someone else believes they can. We are so used to canceling, condemning, and publicly correcting that we forget some of the greatest transformations happen in quiet, consistent acts of relationship. That doesn't mean excusing harm. It doesn't mean giving up accountability. But it does mean asking, what is the actual goal here? To punish or to transform? Because if we want fewer extremists, we need more exits. And exits are built through relationships. Some people might read all of this and say, okay, but that's just one person. What about the overwhelming number of extremists out there? I understand that. The scale of hate can feel too big, too entrenched, too loud to fight with anything other than rage or retreat. But the truth is, people are radicalized one person at a time, which means if there's still hope, we reach people the same way, one at a time. And I want to interject here because that happened this summer to me. You know, there's someone that we had just been, like, we just didn't talk to each other. It had been years and years and years. And we crossed paths at Reggae on the River, and he actually kind of gave me a smile, and I just kind of looked and walked away. And then I stopped and I said, "No, Agnes, you need to walk your talk." And I went back and I found him and I apologized for not recognizing his smile. And there was a lot of banter back and forth, but a half hour later, we found ourselves giving each other a hug and putting that all behind. And I saw him again recently and there were hugs. And that is what you have to do. She continues, "I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not even saying it's always possible. But I am saying it starts with not becoming the thing we're trying to dismantle. If we dehumanize those across from us, if we write them off as monsters and not as people caught in a web of fear, disconnection, and pain, we risk losing the very humanity we're fighting for. So I invite you to resist the urge to flatten people down to their worst beliefs. Hold your boundaries, yes. Speak truth, always. But don't let the hate of others shrink your capacity to remain human in the face of it. Because the work of transformation, real, lasting, slow, gritty change, starts not with them, but with how we choose to see. Even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. When people used to ask what I did, I never said counseling or social services. I said the work of transformation, because that's what it is. It wasn't about managing behavior or checking boxes. It was about sitting with people in their brokenness and still seeing their wholeness. It was about believing, not naively, but intentionally, that change is possible. In Anishinaabe Ojibwe teachings, healing is always a relational process. It's not about fixing someone, it's about restoring balance. The seven grandfather teachings remind us that transformation happens when we practice humility, honesty, truth, wisdom, love, respect, and bravery, all in relationship. You don't become whole by yourself. You become whole in relation to your community, your ancestors, your spirit, and the land you walk on. And so when I talk about helping people out of extremism or hate, I don't mean talking them out of it with logic. I mean inviting them back into relationship, back into the circle, into a sense of being connected to something larger and more life-giving than violence and hatred. Sometimes empathy is the most radical act of all. And that is Robert Mirabel, The Dance. I'm going to close with Shin Goose. It's it's vinyl. Can you believe that? And so, and it's called Living on Indian Time. Again, give us a call, 707-923-3911.
I spoke from the north, changing our climate to cold. We didn't build great fires to melt the ice. Instead, we moved a little further south. Yes, we all adapted when the asphalt melted. Back to the good life we did go. 'Cause we were living on Indian time, living on Indian time. Gonna live my life on Indian time. And the time may come, and the time may go, but I'll still be living. sun now. Everyone's in high gear, heading down that road to depression. And when it all goes flash, I'll be taking it back, back up in a country cold stream. There's no need to rush, back up in the bush. Take the time to live out our dream, 'cause we are living on Indian time. Living on Indian time. Gonna live my life on Indian time. And the time may come and the time may go, I'm still living on Indian time.
To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.